Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash Burnett.
Welcome back to a very special edition of Berlin Inside Out, Tallinn Inside Out, here from the Lennart Meri Conference in Tallinn, where we bring you more talk of the town. To fuel that FOMO you have from not being here, we're joined by three people who we know well and who are experts in their respective fields. Balkan, Hannah, Richards, please introduce yourselves to our listeners.
Hi, everyone. My name is Richards Kohls. I'm the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Parliament of Latvia. And I'm thrilled to have this conversation, looking back on the full day of conversation at the Lennart Meri Conference.
We're delighted to have you on the show, especially as we've had your two musketeer colleagues on in the past. We've had Gigis Pavlionis and Marco Mikkelsen, and now finally we have you after your leg injury kept you out of our last planned recording together.
The triumvirate is complete for Berlin Inside Out here in Tallinn.
Hannah.
My name's Hannah Notte. I'm the director of the Eurasia Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Monterey, California. And I'm also a senior non-resident associate with CSIS in Washington, D.C., though I am based in Berlin. And I'm very happy to be joining you today.
Thank you. Thanks for agreeing to come on the show. Now, regular listeners will know and recognize the inimitable voice and views of Balkan Devlin. Balkan, welcome back. Tell us who you still are.
Oh, well, thanks, Ben, and no pressure at all. My name is Balkan Devlin. I'm the director of the Transatlantic Program at the MacDonald Laurier Institute, which is a national think tank in Canada.
Very good. So we've had a full day at Lennart Meri today. There were sessions last night, and then starting early in the morning, they're really working us hard. The first session started at 8:15, and Aaron and I have recorded two separate podcast sessions since then, and we've had a really full session of presentations. But what's caught your eye? Richards, you were on the panel this morning about seizing Russian assets from freezing to seizing.
Yeah, that is the missing link, where the West is still somewhat hesitating in making decisive decisions. Of course, everything is surrounded with legality discussion, but I think it's not the case. It's the case to really show that we are decisive when we can go ahead. And the question is how and when. Well, we see the fine example of the ongoing discussions when it comes to sanctions, right? We already up front announced to Russia that we're going to prepare the 14th sanction package. It involved this, that, and another, and so on. That makes him, you know, starting point to start to circumvent and avoid and so on. So what we actually discussed, and there was somewhat a consensus building in a room, that Russia needs to be given a cold shower on instant decision, like, on a fortnight, just coming out and saying, we are seizing. The assets are going to Ukraine's support, be it rebuilding, reconstruction, military, and et cetera. The questions right now surrounds in what ways. Everyone waits for the G7 meeting in June, but I think we can already push ahead before that. And I would argue that there are different aspects that we can put in motion already. The Europe has already given the legal framework that we can withhold these windfall interest rates. Well, because the central bank assets of Russia, they're in only a few handful of countries. They're not across all EU member states. So it's up to them how they're going to work with the windfall interest rates, the income, which amounts to 3 billion annually. And just to conclude, the idea that was in the room that is really triggering, that we can provide, you know, indefinite financial support annually amounting 30 billion to Ukraine, is that we take a loan and then each year from that windfall interest rate, we pay the interest rate to those who we've taken the loan. And where we can get the loan, we don't have to look outside the EU. Let's take from the Nordic pension funds.
Special contribution to Nordic-Baltic relations there from Riyadh.
Yes, exactly. Well, one thing that I think that came up in that particular session was goes really to the theme of the entire conference. Let us not despair, but act. And that there's a lot of pessimism flowing around. We certainly experienced that a lot in Berlin. All of this list of things we cannot do because of this, we cannot do because of that. The discussion around seizing assets is a big part of that. We can't do it because of legal reasons, economic reasons, this sort of thing. But did you get a sense from that conversation or any other conversations you've had, that maybe we are actually moving towards a more decisive approach to dealing with Russia. And the question of whether we should seize assets is just one way
This is, I think, the main theme should be surrounding the Leonard Merry conference. Can we agree on one particular way of how we define the strategic defeat of Russia? Because there are 50 shades of strategic defeat of Russia, defending from the capital to capital. In Germany, is let's not let Ukraine lose. And in Baltics, it's still the victory. And then there are others, as long as it's necessary, which is, again, so vague and so on. So I think I will use Žygimantas Pavilionis, his advocacy when he is in Washington, D.C. He's putting his fist on a table and saying, we need Casablanca Conference. Do you know the Casablanca Conference, 1943? It's Churchill and Roosevelt together defined. There will be no negotiations with the Nazi Germany. It's only total defeat. This should be applicable to Russia, at least as they described as collective West.
Right, and we actually talked about this on the other Talk of the Town session this morning with Matt Kranig and other guests. And Matt's, of course, just released a book that's called We Win, They Lose. Ronald Reagan's famous comment that actually some of these very complex issues are quite simple if you think them through. And that quest for victory, which, as Richard has said, is not shared by everyone at the moment. And we end up risking strategically defeating ourselves. Now, Balkan, we've just come from a panel about NATO's 75th anniversary, and there was a lot of celebratory, self-congratulatory talk about what has been done, but there were some questions about what hasn't as well.
Exactly. Before getting to that, two points perhaps about the seizing of the assets. Aaron wrote about it, so he can talk more on that. But one thing, one of the primary oppositions to the idea that this would create a precedent, right? And then people will not invest, blah, 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 which is, of course, complete nonsense. Because if you are engaging in crime of aggression against your neighbors and committing war crimes and genocide, yes, you should be worried about... Exactly. You should be worried about getting your assets seized.
And
right?
we can't allow it to become normalized behavior.
Right?
This is about setting that precedent.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So that is the precedent we should be setting rather than avoiding it, right? The number two point is that we need to, when we get to the moving part, we need to break the barrier of fear, right? The fear of action that we keep concerned about, what the Russians would do. Let's move and take action and break that particular barrier. The third point, which is your question about what was not talked about, I wasn't particularly convinced with the Undersecretary's comments about that, things were given in a timely manner and in timely fashion, drip feeding Ukrainians ammunition and weapon systems, delivering things too late, too little, is one of the reasons why we end up here today.
Well, I mean, the message I think that we are hearing that we often say is let's not self-deter ourselves, right? And this comes up in a few different topics. This certainly comes up in the seizing of the assets. Let's not be afraid of our power to actually do this. Let's just do it. We have escalation dominance in the financial field. Let's go ahead. But that was also a theme that very much came up during that session that Balkan's just talking about right now, where Assistant Secretary Celeste Wallander from the U.S. Made certain remarks that some of us raised our eyebrows at during the session. This sort of self-deterrence, which has motivated this drip of support to Ukraine. What did you make of that?
It struck me during the last session that it seems to me over 2 years into this war, we still have this, what I would call a stakes conundrum in this war. I think there are those people who still haven't understood what is at stake with the war in Ukraine, the consequences that a Russian victory would have, what it would mean for European security, what it might mean for nuclear proliferation across the globe, what precedent it might set for Indo-Pacific. So those people seem to say, the stakes are really not that high in Ukraine. What happens in Ukraine doesn't really matter for us. And I think across the European continent, we still have constituencies who would support that. And then there are those who say, well, the stakes are actually too high. If we push Russia too much, we might see the use of a tactical nuclear weapon in Ukraine. And so you have sort of what I would call the stakes conundrum, where there are those who think the stakes are too low, and there are those who think that the stakes are too high, and both sort of prevent sufficient support for Ukraine, but coming at it from different perspectives. And that is a problem because we are faced, I think, with a Russia that is a single-purpose actor. Russia's entire statecraft, its entire global foreign policy has been recalibrated to stand firm in this confrontation with the West over Ukraine, whereas we in the West still get pulled into all sorts of different directions and considerations. I didn't attend the session on the assets this morning. I was in a different session on export controls and sanctions, you know, discussing why it is that Russia still has very high income from selling oil, why it is the case that we're not taking more of Russia's shadow fleet off the market, why it is that we're not enforcing the price cap on Russian oil sufficiently, why it is the case that the so-called roundabout trade through third countries is still in motion. And again, we sort of come to all sorts of domestic considerations or not wanting to impose secondary sanctions, not wanting to drive up gas prices for the American consumer ahead of the US elections. So these different considerations that interfere. Whereas, again, we are focused with a Russia that is singularly focused upon winning this war. And I think this what I would call the stakes conundrum, sort of stuck with me throughout the day as I was listening to the conversations.
Thanks. That's such a useful insight. And we're going to come to Richard's in just one second, but I'd like to put that out there in terms of the seeming problem that we have. Rather than focusing on what we have done so far and justifying ourselves, there's a lot that we haven't. And you've just highlighted so many of those measures in the economic field. But in that last discussion on the military side and military aid and support to Ukraine, it's made so manifestly clear what we haven't done when we see what was done for Israel when defending against that massive air attack from Iran. We showed the possibilities of our capabilities there, and we're not giving a fraction of that to support Ukraine, which is much more directly in Europeans' interest, certainly, although they're both worthy causes, of course.
Well, if I may on that, so obviously the Baltics already on 24th of February, so 23rd, we provided lethal weapons. I don't know if it's widely known or not, but we gave the anti-aircraft man-powered rockets, actually.
We actually spoke to Aris Pabriks last night, who was very proud that his Stingers, as he calls them, he was sent Latvia's Stingers, went to Hostomel.
Well, exactly. It actually, I think, saved Kyiv. But it's, well, obviously it's 113 days since that, and we're still way back on delivering on what we have promised. We absolutely rightly pointed out we keep circling the red lines around ourselves, limiting the capabilities that we can provide. And just wanted to say, I don't know if it's true or not, but I believe it is. The Patrusha, right? Just the closed meeting of the Russia Security Council leaked information about his rhetoric, what was being. It's circulating on media. But one point he's stating that what he was mentioning, the fear is our main weapon. And, you know, if we look not only at the political leadership, but to the states, but if we go to the human being, fear is something that paralyzes you to make a decision, to make an action and so on. And this is what they're constantly dripping in different parts. Fear of nuclear weapon using, you know, dirty bomb or tactical or whatever. It was counted how many times since 24th of February Russian propagandists or the leadership has mentioned the nuclear attack. It was 300 something. It's like every second day there is this rhetoric. And this is something that keeps us paralyzed because, whoa, but this means at some point they really do. I don't think Putin is ready to do that. It's way too much for him to lose, to trigger something like that. And he has right now the bigger brother. Russia is a vassal state of China. And China has clearly stated there won't be use of any, even tactical nukes, because that is obviously a loose policy that won't work for either party.
We've heard about lots of justification for what has been delivered, as you said, and not, you know, really enough focus on what we actually need. But what strikes me is that I personally think if you deliver enough, you don't have to justify yourself, right? But in that last session on NATO just now that we saw, especially with Celeste Volander, we saw a lot of justification of what has been delivered, especially by the U.S., but also by other allies. And she sent a certain message that the NATO summit will have a clear message from the U.S. and from allies that Putin is wrong about our level of commitment that we've been able to demonstrate to Ukraine so far. Obviously, Russia has shown itself that it's very committed. Hannah, as you just said, it has basically formulated its entire society around this particular goal. So that's kind of interesting. What kind of message would that have to be? Because she didn't say what it was going to be. What would we need to see? So Hannah, let's start with you on this question.
Well, she talked about some of the deliverables that she's hoping for from the NATO summit, right? She talked about 32 NATO allies committing 2% of spending. She talked about fully sourcing, I think, military units for various regional programs. But yeah, questions regarding a pathway for Ukraine for NATO membership, you know, we didn't sort of hear clear answers from the panel.
I've never heard quite so many adjectives used to describe a bridge as we've heard in the last afternoon since Tony Blinken's comments about needing a bridge for Ukraine. It's well lit, it's short, it's straight, etc. It's reliable, but it's still not NATO membership.
Bridge nowhere.
Well, you know, the bridge is the most unstable structure in architecture, actually.
Well, now, you don't live on bridges, right? You pass through bridges.
Well, let's be clear. There's one bridge we'd love to see blow up. We all know which one that is.
That's true. But Hannah, in terms of how the Russians are seeing this, I mean, Richard's just mentioned this sort of leak. I mean, I don't think that's any surprise. Is it the Russians working with fear, playing on our own fears? How do we overcome that?
You know, I'll be quite frank, I'm not sure that fear can be totally overcome, because fear of nuclear war, of a nuclear weapon, that's quite a formidable nuclear fear for humans to deal with. I think that we are in a situation where we will likely face a Russian Federation with which we will be in confrontation for a very, very long period to come, and that Russia has nuclear weapons and will be continuously manipulating and using that nuclear fear. So we need to have a much more, I think, nuanced and informed conversation in our societies of how to deal with it, because it's not going to go away. And there is other measures that Russia can take, and I anticipate we will see more of those short of nuclear use over the course of this conflict. We have already seen many Russian measures. Russia has essentially walked away from nuclear arms control. It has suspended its participation in the New START treaty. It has hinted that it could be testing a nuclear weapon. It has de-ratified the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. It is now, and I hope we'll talk about sort of in the Pacific and Middle East as well, because those are themes at the conference. Russia is now enabling both North Korea and Iran, no longer a partner on nuclear non-proliferation. So my point here to you is that we are faced with a Russia that is continuously trying to raise what I would call the nuclear temperature more broadly, short of using a nuclear weapon. And that is a new environment that we Europeans are still incredibly uncomfortable with and need to grow more comfortable with and in terms of how to deal with it. But I'm not sure that a fear of nuclear use in a conflict is something that you can sort of fully rid people of.
No, but Richards, it's not the fear, it's what you do with it, right?
No. I think one thing that NATO has to show, we mean business. Not only, you know, refilling our stocks and you know, fueling our military industry to the maximum capacity and beyond, but also putting to the practice certain things. I think right now is the time for the Baltic Sea GPS blocking scheme that is obvious coming from certain parts of Russia's territory, to give a blow to that particular infrastructure, because that is absolutely interfering and that is endangering our people's lives, and that is already violating our space as such. And that should be already, I mean, I'm not talking even about those incursions of rockets into Poland and Romania that also have somewhat tested. There's actually two casualties in Poland, two civilians got killed. And then we are still kind of, you know, and it's not, well, it was misfired rocket. No, it was intentionally targeted and it entered NATO's airspace. And we did nothing. So with GPS right now, which is massive, massive, being blocking in Baltic Sea, Finland is even, you know, suspending their flights. That is something where NATO has to respond with force.
Right, because otherwise we send a signal.
By force, it's you can kick out those signals and others and go beyond that.
So because otherwise we send the signal we are afraid.
And no, we're not capable to retaliate. They can do whatever they want in our backyard. Point.
And this was a lesson from the Cold War as well, Balkan, right? We had to show that we weren't going to give in to blackmail in order that it doesn't actually work and they don't keep trying it.
Exactly. On the nuclear component, MAD still holds. Mutually Assured Destruction still holds. We do have a nuclear escalation fear. So does the Russians. I mean, Putin's regime, Kremlin, may be a lot of things, including being evil, but they are not suicidal. You do not stay at the top of such a regime by being suicidal, right? This is a guy who sits 20 feet away from others because he was scared, that he'll catch COVID, right? So
he's pointing at Richards, but I think he means
up there. So this is not a guy that will necessarily willingly to walk in into a nuclear escalation ladder, right? And you know, just to go back to the sort of old Bolshevik dictum, which could be apocryphal, but where the you prod with bayonets. If you meet steel, you pull back. If you meet flesh, you go through. Is exactly what Russia has been doing historically. When it is being pushed back, Russians move back. So we have to take the nuclear escalation component with the idea that Russians don't want to die. Putin definitely doesn't want to die. His cronies doesn't want to die. And once you get into a nuclear escalation ladder, you don't know where it would go. And there are other options that they actually horizontally escalating by including targeting civilian infrastructure, continuously to do so, et cetera, et cetera. There are other options that are militarily more beneficial and psychologically more beneficial than using nuclear weapons, plus the China factor, right?
Well, Irish fishermen, they're very effective.
I mean,
why we have an Irish general now at the head of the military committee.
In all seriousness, if we use the Irish fisherman example for a second, I mean, you know, the Russians folded pretty quickly when actually, you know, confronted with, we're going to do something about this, you know? So, I mean, you know, there is the sense, of course, that there's a, you know, I mean, yeah, Putin has to have a huge table because he's afraid. We do not have this table around us right now. It's a much smaller one. So, what are some of the other highlights that you also had today from some of the panels? We had sessions on narratives. We obviously had sessions on a new arms race, and indeed the one that we have been talking about a lot, on 75 years of NATO.
And Balkan, no pressure at all to say the other highlight was the other recording of Berlin Inside Out Live here at the conference with Timothy Snyder, Elliot Cohen, Marcus Tachner, and Anna Xavier. No pressure, Balkan.
No, not at all. But I'd like to pick on that last point. Perhaps I'll leave the other panel discussions to my colleagues here. My take from that live session of Tallinn Inside Out was, well, first, there are a couple interesting conversations, but the thing really that I think was very beneficial and everyone should really go back and listen to it was the deep dive when we talk about values versus interests and why that's actually a false dichotomy, right? As I like to say, and as Ben says, you know, our values are our interests, but you know, our interests are downstream from our values, right? Very basic interests such as sovereignty or territorial integrity are fundamentally because we value political independence. You know, if they can give you $100,000 every citizen, and but you will not be sovereign or you will not be politically independent, a lot of people would refuse that, right? Because we value our political independence. So our interests are downstream from values. And by artificially separating this, which really did came out in the session, we are undermining ourselves by creating possible wedges for others to go like, this is not in your interest. Do not pursue that one. So that's, I think, one of the highlights for me.
And one thing that came up on that panel, too, was that democracy is not simply a motherhood and apple pie kind of value. It is actually a security interest, because if you're surrounded by other democracies, you know, you don't fight each other. That helps to provide for your own security.
It does, as does the fundamental freedoms and human rights that democracy ensures. There's also security of the person, freedom of conscience, all of the things that we really hold dear. And that's where we would say our values are our interests. Hannah, what else has stood out for you in your time here at Lennart Meri?
I would say that the conference is also doing a good job of what I call connecting the dots, connecting different issues across the globe. I attended the session on the Indo-Pacific, where we talked about perhaps a looming crisis in the Taiwan Strait, but also what's going on with North Korea. And of course, what we have is a growing partnership between Russia, China, and the DPRK. North Korea is supporting Russia's war against Ukraine, but Russia is also perhaps giving certain capabilities to the North Koreans that are fueling Pyongyang's risk appetite on the Korean Peninsula. We'll have a session later tonight on the Middle East and who's benefiting from conflict in the Middle East. Now, don't get me wrong, you know, Russia is not the architect of tensions in the Indo-Pacific. Russia is not the architect of the war in Gaza. But Russia's cooperation with Iran and Russia's cooperation with North Korea is having an impact on how those actors conduct themselves in these other regions. And we as the West, you know, the United States, Europe, we are also thinking about those crises. You, Ben, mentioned Israel earlier and what we did with Israel. Well, yeah, after October 7th, the United States moved Patriot battalions into the Middle East. And there was a formidable show of force by the U.S. and its allies on April 13th when Iran attacked Israel. But that also then led the Ukrainians to say, well, what about our air defenses? So, of course, policy decisions are made in a resource-constrained environment. And as we have sort of metastasizing crises across the globe, which are not exclusively but partially fueled by Russia, I think connecting these dots and understanding how what's happening with DPRK, what's happening in the Middle East and what's happening in Ukraine is sort of having these inner linkages and fully understanding the nuances of these inner linkages is also incredibly important. And so I think it's great that we have these sessions here as well. I'll be talking, for example, tomorrow morning in a session about Iranian weapons support to Russia. And again, I'll make the point that that's a big problem for the battlefield in Ukraine. But we also want to ask the question what the Russians are giving the Iranians in return and what effect that will have on dynamics in the Middle East. Because again, these things cannot be fully disentangled.
Such important points there. Absolutely. We have to deal with these things in a coherent and comprehensive way, don't we, Riyaz?
Well, yes. Obviously, thank you for bringing this up yesterday as well, the OWL session. It was the freedom for peace, in a way. And I tried to provoke...
Those who would trade freedom for peace deserve
neither. Yeah, they deserve the both, yes. But I kind of suggested for the panelists to, instead of the word freedom, put the word impunity. Impunity for peace. Are we ready to trade that? And this is something, the lessons from the 20th century as well. The one that was really emboldened to act as it acts in 21st century is because of the impunity in 20th century. The Soviet Union, Red Army, none of them. They committed heinous war crimes in Eastern Europe, in the Baltics, deportations, you name it. And none of them were accountable or went to the trials. So that emboldened them in the end of 20th century and 21st century to act the way they act, how they acted in the first days of incursion in 24th of February, what we saw the whole world afterwards, Bucha, Irpin, and so on. It didn't come as a surprise. It's because the Russian army, they know that, you know, they will get away because they're part of the Security Council. Their leadership will cover all the crimes and so on. None of them will be accountable. They're, for God's sake, they're sending prisoners to the battlefield when they, you know, fight, you know, killers, you know, assassins, and then, you know, they return to their societies and be full-fledged. So this is somewhat crippled. What I wanted to mention is it's not actually putting together the dots. The dots have the name, and the name is Axis of Evil. That's how they should be labeled, the Russia, Iran, China, North Korea. That is exactly what they are. The war in Ukraine, Russian war in Ukraine, the Middle East conflict are not isolated conflicts. Yes, I agree. It's not maybe Russia directly involved in Middle East right now conflict, but everything that went up to 7th of October, enforcing, training, arming Hamas, etc. It is two regimes hand in hand. It's the Tehran and Moscow very much. We see that after the 7th of October, Hamas is traveling to Moscow. I mean, when the West pulls out of NATO, pulls out of Afghanistan, where does Taliban travel? To Moscow and others. It's just, this is something that is happening in front of our eyes when the West is still fighting each other on different arguments. They are cooperating. Just recent one, Putin and, well, somebody said that I do not pronounce correctly. I pronounce it as a Latvian xi, but she or he or... Sorry.
Careful, we'll get into a pronouns debate in a second.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's why I say xi. Yeah.
Okay, there's a session on the Middle East coming up tonight, and whoever scheduled that after drinks was clearly showing no fear whatsoever.
Well, you need a drink to deal with the Middle East.
Well, there we go. That's the other way of looking at it.
Different philosophy. Actually, I think that's that reminds me what you were talking about just now, the new axis of evil. We had a speaker here at Leonard Mary Shalatorota who used different terminology. She called it the coalition of jerks. Which and we have to understand that these things are not in isolation, right? This is exactly the point.
May I propose a slight amendment from axis of evil to circle of jerks?
That will undermine their morale too. Evil sounds too cool for them.
Yeah, exactly. Really, they're just a coalition of jerks who are afraid of COVID and therefore have to have a long table. You know, but otherwise,
Aaron, what else is coming up?
Yeah, but otherwise, let's ask you guys quickly what you're looking forward to. We have several things. We have a Russian disinformation panel that you are speaking on tomorrow, Ben.
I am, which is about joining dots in other ways, joining dots from foreign policy to our domestic situation, understanding that Russian disinformation, as well as other malign activity, works in the cracks in our societies, which we create, and frankly, we need to fix. So that's why we need a coherent approach, not only to dealing with the circle of jerks, as they shall be known going forward, but also to our domestic issues, as well as our foreign policy posture.
Yeah, and you mentioned the session that you are also chairing tomorrow. This is one of the issues of Leonard Mary. There's so many things happening at the same time, and sometimes you have to pick and choose. But here's one last panel. Can we turn the Baltic Sea into a NATO lake? Very curious about what you think about this, Rikards.
Yeah, I know it sounds like funny and so on, lake and so on. Lake means there is no need then for presence, permanent presence. So it's still something that we have to heavily invest in our defense. I mean, we'll see how the new defense plans are unfolding, because after Sweden accession, we have to revise the already adopted plans after Finland joined. It's the procedure. But yeah, it's obviously has way limited Russia's capabilities, especially in the Navy area, in the Baltic Sea, and I think beyond as well, looking up in high north. As well, we'll see how the new command structures are working out, Brunsum, Norfolk, and etc. I just hope the Nordics will stick with the Baltics. but that's for the future discussions.
As long as you don't ask them about their pension funds again, Rihards, I think.
Yeah, it's a good investment. Imagine to get 10% interest rate back. I mean, where else are you going to get a better deal?
You heard it here first. Yeah. Balkan, what are you looking forward to?
I mean, there are a number of things, but I'm really looking forward to one of the night owl sessions that focuses on lessons learned. Because, I mean, for us, going forward, as Russia is not an acute threat, it's a chronic threat that we would need to deal with. And they are learning different lessons. Iran is learning, North Korea is China, they are learning. We need to figure out what lessons we could also learn and understand what lessons Russians are learning.
As well as winning the tactical adaptation battle, we need to win the strategic adaptation battle. Otherwise, this is going to look very bad for us. Hannah, apart from your own panel tomorrow, What else are you looking forward
to? Well, two things. So first of all, I'll be very sad to miss a parallel session that runs in parallel to my panel, which is on the situation in the South Caucasus, where, you know, we have a situation in Georgia where a foreign agent law was just passed. We have a, I think, you know, precarious situation in Armenia after the exodus of Karabakh Armenians from Nagorno-Karabakh last fall. So there's a lot in flux in the South Caucasus that is also, I think, quite directly related to the impact of Russia's war against Ukraine. So I think that should be an interesting discussion. But I'll also say that I really just look forward to having more conversations with folks on the sidelines. You know, I live and work in Berlin. I work mostly on Russia's foreign policy outside of Europe, you know, so with the Irans and the North Koreas and in the Middle East. I don't really work on the Baltic region in my work. And of course, there's so many excellent people here from different countries in the Baltic region. So I'm just, you know, networking, speaking with people, very excited to hear perspectives from this region because I'm not, you know, exposed to it so much in sort of my day-to-day work. And so for me, that's almost the biggest benefit coming to this conference for the second year now in a row.
I agree. Making friends and trying to influence people is definitely part of the game here. And we're all having a blast doing it, it has to be said too. It's a lot of really serious issues. But when you have such great allies to talk to them about, it becomes a pleasant exercise as well as a seriously important one. Hannah, you're based in Berlin. We hear your voice in our debate a lot, which is great. It's been fantastic to have. When Richards, you've come to Berlin, Balkan, same thing. We need those strong voices to push Germany to do what it needs to do, however long it takes, to whatever it takes, and make sure that it is victory. Thanks very much for talking to us today here at the Lennart Meri Conference, and we look forward to continuing the conversation here and in Berlin in the future. Thank you all.